Hello and welcome to the Food Medic podcast. I'm Dr. Hazel Wallace, founder of the Food Medic. I'm a qualified doctor, personal trainer, blogger, and best-selling author of the books The Food Medic and The Food Medic for Life. I'm passionate about maximizing our health through how we live our lives, including the food that we eat, physical activity, and stress management. We will hear from leading experts in their field who will be sharing evidence-based advice on how we can live healthier lives, and we will cut through the confusing information that we find online. I like to think of myself as one of the first of a new generation of doctors. Hello and welcome back to the Food Medic podcast. Today I'm joined by not just one but two guests, Dr. Zoe Williams and Dr. John Sykes. Zoe and John are both GPs who are passionate about lifestyle medicine. Zoe is a portfolio GP with multiple roles, including Public Health England Lead Clinical Champion for Physical Activity, the RCGP Clinical Champion Physical Activity and Lifestyle, and CCG Clinical Associate Obesity and Lifestyle. Zoe is also a resident doctor on ITV This Morning and co-presents on the BBC series Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, in addition to many other TV shows and documentaries. And you might have recognised her from a couple of years back on Gladiator. I know, I mentioned it. John is a GP based in Bath who has a keen interest in lifestyle medicine and is a director of the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine. John has also organised and run several conferences, including the RCGP Lifestyle Medicine Conference in June 2017, winning the local Vibrant Faculty Award 2017 in the Severn Deanery, and also hosts many teaching sessions on lifestyle medicine for students and healthcare practitioners. Guys, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us. Gosh, yeah. That was a mouthful, wasn't it?
I know. And that was me condensing your bios because you both do so much, which is absolutely amazing and one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on here. And for a bit of background, I actually know Zoe and John outside of this kind of podcast space because how did we meet? Through lifestyle medicine, through really a shared passion.
Yeah, I think so. We're sort of three parts of a larger group of lifestyle medics, and I guess we're an emerging force in the medical world.
Yeah, absolutely. And we all have like this, we're part of this WhatsApp group as well, which is so shout out to our WhatsApp crew.
Shout out to the lifestyle medic crew.
Oh my god. So I think we should explain to everyone what lifestyle medicine actually is, because it's a bit of a new term. Zoe, I'm gonna let you take this first question.
Yeah, okay. So I guess it is a new term in that we're talking about lifestyle medicine, but it's not a new thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's been around since the beginning of medicine. Really, to simplify it, it's looking at the upstream causes of illness and disease. So rather than, for example, focusing on the type 2 diabetes or the depression and treating that, it's focusing on the person, and not just the person's physical health, but their emotional health, their social surroundings, their environment, and thinking about what came before to cause that illness. So if you go one step back, you might think about diet and physical activity and sleep, but we're trying to think even before that, is it that person's social circumstances? So really taking that full holistic view of the person and thinking how, in addition to drugs and interventions, can we help them address that? And, you know, it's not a new thing and every GP practices some element of lifestyle medicine, but I think in some respects it's become the norm and possibly easier to prescribe a pill for every ill than to really dig deeper. And I think sometimes patients actually expect for their problem to be addressed by the doctor or treated by the doctor as well. So it's not new. It's almost in some ways going back to how medicine used to be done before we had all the amazing drugs and interventions that we have today. And that's not to say that we won't give the drugs and do the interventions. Of course, without those, we would really struggle as GPs. And I actually remember John saying in a lifestyle medicine meeting one time, if my patient has a cholesterol of 8, he's getting a statin. So it's not that we're anti-drugs or anti-interventions, but it's about if a patient has, for example, depression, we tend to, as GPs, be very good at talking about antidepressants and talking about talking therapies. We might be less good at informing the patient about how much physical activity may improve their illness or how much changes in their diet or actually looking at addressing their stress or sleep might improve their condition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the reason it's a little bit, I guess, an unfamiliar term for a lot of listeners and maybe even doctors is because it's not something that we really learn at medical school. And just touching on what you said, when it comes to lifestyle intervention, what we mean is the things that we can do in our lives, and that's not just diet, it's not just exercise, it's sleep, it's stress management, it's also our social lives.
Yeah, and actually Rob Lawson, who's the director of the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine, he's got a neat little soundbite actually, and he says, if nutrition and physical activity are the penicillin of lifestyle medicine, then the surgery is sort of the psychology and the behaviour change, because it's really about behaviour change. And you could say that the community and the community assets and, you know, whatever you have, churches, job centres, or all those people who are trying to help you, that could be the hospital when it comes to lifestyle medicine.
Yeah, that's a really, really nice way of putting it. Both of you are still practicing GPs despite doing lots of other things. And I know, John, you probably practice more than all of us. How do you feasibly fit in lifestyle advice into a 10-minute consultation? Because this is something GPs ask me all the time. And I'd love to know what have been, I guess, your solutions to getting around this problem.
Yeah, I think it's really tricky. I think we, you know, touching on what Zoe said, we know that 70 to 80% of kind of things that we see in general practice are rooted in lifestyle choices. And I think that's really important to touch on, because when so much of it is rooted in lifestyle, it means it has to be a part of our management plan. Mm. And we know that so many medical conditions that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, the first step is lifestyle management. I think one key thing about this is making lifestyle changes easy and simple, but also kind of specific to our patients, and enjoying the benefits that we get from that, from seeing the results. Because ultimately, when we see patients make lifestyle changes and that benefits their health, then we kind of get to see the results that we really want to see. Because ultimately, I mean, one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about lifestyle medicine is it's exciting, because you get to see patients change their lives. You get to see patients go from, you know, being maybe quite socially isolated, maybe quite physically inactive, to changing their lives around. Because ultimately, we have become GPs, or we've become medical professionals, because we've wanted to make people healthier and happier and live more fulfilling lives. And that's a great thing about lifestyle medicine. Mm. It has potential to do so much of that. So your question about how do you fit it into 10 minutes, I think it's really tricky.
Yeah,
I think it's about having evidence-based messages, which you can deliver in a short period of time, which you've kind of just got as a little reserve bank.
Yeah.
Kind of having an open discussion with the patient about which aspects of the kind of five lifestyle areas, which I think you highlighted really well at the start of this chat, so physical activity, diet, sleep, stress management and community, highlighting and checking with the patient what kind of things they feel they could change, making smart goals around that. So specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and also got a bit of a time frame to it, so that people have got something which they can aim towards, which they can then check in with you next time they see you. And it can be a very small part of your consultation, but actually the impact it could have could be massive. And it's exciting to see those changes happen.
Yeah. And I think if we had more robust guidelines in place that GPs could put their hand to when it comes to advice on diet, advice on exercise, sleep, like simple hacks would be really helpful, because I know that we talk about it quite a bit and have our own tips and tricks that are helpful, but it really comes down to information sharing. And also, I know there's a real call for what's evidence-based, but if it's a small tip that can help a patient, I think that could make a big difference as well.
Definitely. I think a lot of these small tips aren't that hard to give either.
Yeah.
Because actually, when we think about some small, simple changes that a lot of people can make, which make a big difference to their overall health, these aren't complicated messages. And then, as Zoe's correctly said, like directing to the right professionals off the back of that. I know in previous podcasts, you've talked about health coaches and health trainers, and also directing to exercise referral schemes. And that's just kind of maybe from a physical activity point of view. But knowing those community things that we can refer on to and utilizing the whole team is actually going to be a way in which we can really help patients to learn more about lifestyle medicine and just use the resources we've got available.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I think I always like to talk about positive things, but actually, you know, if we look at the bigger picture of the NHS, which has now been around for 70 years, we have to accept the NHS's demands have changed so much. 70 years ago, we were treating people if anything, for undernourishment and infections mostly. We were in the post-war era, food was still rationed, and most people who needed treatment needed it for a short period of time, then they either died or they got better. Whereas now we have people being diagnosed with multiple chronic diseases that they will live with for 50, 60, 70 years. And during that time, they'll need a lot of support from healthcare professionals. So I feel that the NHS, in order to survive, has to sort of move from a model of treating disease and sickness towards encouraging health and well-being. And if we don't do that, then we're going to run out of resources. And yeah. I dread to think what will happen then. We all have a role to play in that. GPs are just one part of it. Everyone working in the healthcare system, but also patients as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I like that kind of that phrase of moving away from sick care to healthcare or health gain. And that's something that I guess we can all focus on, which is quite positive. And just moving away from that, Zoe, I know that you are super into fitness and also you're an ex-gladiator and we've trained together quite a few times. And you're also really passionate about getting girls into sport, which I think is incredible. But what are the biggest challenges you find in encouraging teenage girls to actually take part in physical activity, and how can we overcome this?
Okay, I think if I had the simple answer as to how we overcome it, I'd be really happy working on it. Yeah, no, it's an area that I'm passionate about because, first of all, the statistic that girls who are aged 5 to 7, only 23% of those girls are physically active enough for good health. By the time we get to 13 to 15 year olds, only 9% are. So 9% of teenage girls are doing enough physical activity to be healthy, which is 60 minutes a day. And that to me is crushing for several reasons. One, it's crushing because that is impacting on their health. But two, because there's so much to be gained from sport and physical activity. And I feel that as somebody who has benefited from sport and physical activity firsthand, I want to share my story with these young girls as much as possible. Often I'm going out to girls who are coming from backgrounds that might be quite similar to my own background. I came from quite a deprived background, single parent family on benefits, had severe asthma, was very, very shy. But I believe that physical activity, sport, and the friends that I've made through that have actually helped me overcome all those barriers so that I've gone on to achieve the things I've achieved. So I think I almost feel like I have a responsibility to share my story with girls in a similar situation to help them believe that they should never feel held back by circumstances that they can't control and that they can achieve anything they want to. And I think physical activity and sport is a great vehicle for doing that. But I think the biggest challenge that they face is an absolute lack of confidence and self-esteem. And 90% of these girls, despite only a small number of them being active enough, 90% of them want to be more physically active. But it's confidence, self-esteem, feeling paranoid about what other people think. That's the biggest factor that holds them back. So with Fit for Life, what we try and do is empower them to change their environment and co-create physical activity programs that they want to be a part of. A very interesting activity that we do with the girls on the Fit for Life program is we get them to work in small groups and list all of the barriers, all of the reasons why they are not being physically active and also why they're not progressing and succeeding as much in life as they would want to. And they come up with a long list. And when we ask them to then try and write down the solutions to those barriers, they really struggle. But if we take the page off them and give them the page of the next table and then say, can you come up with the solutions? They're brilliant and they come with the solutions. Then we go around the room and we share and they realise that actually we all have the same barriers. We've managed to come up with solutions, not just to other people's problems, but our own. And there's this real feeling of empowerment in the room that, oh, we're girls together. We can do this. Actually, the school gym, if the PE teacher will ban the boys on a Wednesday afternoon after school, we'll go to the gym. So it's tricky, and that's one of the things we're doing with Fit for Life is trying to work through what are those barriers and how can we help young girls and young men as well overcome some of those issues.
Yeah. Recently, I did a documentary with BBC Inside at London, and one of the obstacles that we came up against with the kind of younger or the teenage girl was her using a mobile phone device a lot more than, I guess, we used to see teenagers using that, and that's almost become an obstacle and a block in itself for all of us, for all of us, because you kind of go down this warp hole of social media.
Yeah.
And I think we need to almost not ban it, but restrict it within school so that kids are engaging in social activities at least, you know, and then we deal with physical activity.
It was hard enough being a teenager. I can't imagine what it must be like to be a teenager now.
Yeah, I can't imagine at all. Someone told me the other day that the first word that babies are saying now is iPad.
Really?
Used to be book, now it's
iPad.
My
goodness.
Oh my God.
That is terrifying.
Anyway, that's me just taking you guys off on a tangent. But John, you're also a big fan of exercise, and I've heard you speak lots of times, and you've written a couple of articles for the Food Medic website. Can you explain the difference between physical activity or physical inactivity and sedentary behaviour?
Yeah, definitely. So there's this new kind of, I suppose it's not even new, but something that's becoming into the research a lot more is this idea of sitting disease. Now, you can be physically active and hit your 150 minutes of activity for the week and your two muscle strengthening activities. But if you are sedentary, which is sitting for long periods of time during the day, whether it be at work, whether it be commuting or watching TV, then actually you are still at an increased risk of many diseases, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and a range of other things as well. The research is quite clear that the kind of markers for these conditions is increased if we do sit for long periods of time. And in fact, sadly, even our risk of dying of heart disease is increased dramatically from commuting for longer periods in the week and also from watching TV for longer periods. And the stats actually around sitting in the UK are terrifying. So 70% of our day when we're awake is spent sitting. 64 days a year are spent sitting. And it just kind of brings home how much we are kind of spending sitting these days.
Yeah,
I think the physical activity that we used to do 70 years ago, kind of walking every day, was about 15,000 steps, 20,000 steps on average. Compare that to now when we're trying to aim for 10,000 steps a day.
It's interesting. And if we do have sedentary jobs, and lots of us do, we just, you know, that is the modern lifestyle, can we offset our risk? Can we overcome it by being physically active or spreading it out throughout the day?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So the research shows that if we are active for a certain period of that day, then yes, we can. Mm-hmm. But the amount we have to do is quite a lot. In fact, we have to do 60 to 75 minutes of moderate intensity activity in that day in order to offset maybe 7 to 8 hours of sitting. And for most people in the busy schedules that we have, that's unrealistic and not really very manageable. But if we are able to stand for periods of the day when we could be sitting, if we're able to go for a walk or maybe get up every hour, even just to stretch the legs a little bit, we can massively offset that risk of sitting for long periods, which is quite encouraging because we can make those small changes to our day, whether it be having a standing desk, setting an alarm so that we do get up every hour or so to, you know, stand up and stretch our legs a bit. But it is very important that we don't kind of succumb to the chair, really, and just spend most of the day just easily sitting and not doing very much.
Yeah. We all know that 10,000 steps a day is kind of the target that we should be aiming for, or so we're told. But what we're seeing is that actually 10 minutes of vigorous exercise might be better.
Yeah, not even vigorous, just brisk walking. The 10,000 steps, I think it's been a great thing because it's encouraged lots of people to move more. However, it's not based on science or research. It actually was dreamt up by a Japanese chap who wanted to sell pedometers. So it was a very clever marketing ploy. And he called his pedometers 10,000 steps in Japanese. So this 10,000 steps has been adopted and I think has been a good thing. But even if you do 20,000 steps every day, if you're doing that at a slow pace, moving around, not being sedentary, you haven't necessarily done any physical activity because you haven't increased your heart rate, you haven't increased your breathing rate, so you haven't kicked off all those metabolic things that happen when we do exercise. So Public Health England would say that actually, don't stop doing 10,000 steps a day. If you're doing it, that's great, but make sure at least 10 minutes of that is at a pace that gets you a little bit out of breath. So your heart's beating faster and you feel warmer, but you can still have a conversation. And for people really who just think that 10,000 steps is too much, that's unachievable, the great news is, well, okay, if you're going to do something at a brisk pace, it's got to be a 10 minutes of brisk, continuous walking. If you do 10 minutes every day, that reduces your risk of early death by 14% and gets you sort of halfway towards that recommendation of 150 minutes.
I think it's also a bit more, I guess, feasible for a lot of people to be able to fit that in. And if you can do more, again, the more the better. We know that your risk of chronic disease actually reduces the more that you can do, up to a certain point, obviously. But
yeah, there's a dose response curve to physical activity, which kind of explains why the government recommendations are 150 minutes per week. I think for the three of us sat here now in this booth, every week we would do more than 150 minutes. And there are additional health benefits to doing more than 150 minutes. But actually, from just a health perspective, you get the majority of the benefits from 150 minutes, as long as you're doing that at moderate intensity and in blocks of 10 minutes or more. And you actually get 2/3 of that benefit for the first 30 minutes per week that you do. So, you know, as doctors and healthcare professionals, and particularly from a public health standpoint, we really need to encourage the significant numbers of people who do less than 30 minutes per week to do more than that. It's about a quarter of the population that do less than 30 minutes of moderate intensity per week. And that is what's really, really dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something we all need to start shedding a bit, because we do get very vocal about nutrition. But when it comes to physical activity, we are less vocal. And I think that's almost sometimes where we're falling down. Yeah. But it's good to see that we're talking about it a bit more.
I mean, just to touch on that a little bit more, I mean, what's really encouraging is that we know that when we talk about physical activity with our patients, the research actually shows that if we have kind of 12 chats with patients about physical activity, one of them will actually change and become physically active. Now, if we compare that with smoking, say, where in order to get maybe one person to change their smoking habits, we'd have to get 80 to 150 conversations around smoking. Just shows you the impact physical activity can have. I mean, I see maybe nearly 40 patients in a day. And if I speak to every single one of them about physical activity, two of them, maybe three of them are going to become physically active.
I love that.
And actually, the fact that we get so much benefit from going from being inactive and not doing anything to just doing a little bit shows how important that message is.
Just coming on for that, something that me and Zoe spoke about last summer. Zoe, you told me that you leave a cycling helmet on your desk, even though you haven't cycled to work.
Okay, so this is, it's all about nudges. You know, people sometimes require multiple nudges in order to change their behaviours to positive ones. And smoking's a good example, because people often, you know, the more they're told by healthcare professionals and the more times they attempt to quit smoking, the more successful they're likely to be. So with lifestyle medicine, we already said it can be quite time consuming to encourage our patients to make behaviour change. So for a quick win, I leave my cycle helmet on my desk, because even if we don't get around to talking about their physical activity, them seeing my cycle helmet, I'm being a positive role model, because they think I'm cycling, even if I'm not. So that's my, instead of having flowers on my desk or a photograph, I have a cycle helmet.
I think that's great. And I think, you know, maybe we'll see GPs now like bringing their trainers and leaving them in work or something to kind of inspire the patients. And I think we do lead by example.
Can I tell you my little nudge? So my little nudge is at the GP surgery I work, there's a Talloy system for calling in the patient. And I just don't use it. I always go out and get my patient, which prompts every single patient to, oh, is the Talloy broken?
Really?
No, I decided to get my few more steps in by trying to walking in and coming and getting you guys. I'm like, oh, that's good. Oh, so you like being active. Automatically, you get a conversation about physical activity with most patients. And some people just go, oh, you're trying to get more steps in. And it's not doesn't go any further than that. But just that little nudge, I like that term, that little nudge can make a really big difference just to start that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also, like, your colleagues as well kind of click onto it. And one thing that we did in the hospital is pedometer step challenge, and it was a challenge between all the teams, and people got really competitive because we're like, we're going to beat them, we're going to get really like high step count. And although my team didn't win despite my encouragement, it got the whole team taking the stairs for a week, and I think they realized at the end they didn't die and they actually enjoyed walking a bit more. So,
and you don't run later, because actually, you know, those moments in which you greet your patient in the waiting room and guide them to your room, you learn so much about the patient and you build the rapport with them. I think healthcare professionals sometimes don't realise just what an impact their own behaviours can have on the patients. They're such role models. And actually, what I often say when I'm talking about physical activity, and this is true for any lifestyle change, just giving permission, just saying to the patient simply, you would really benefit from being more active, or you would benefit from eating more vegetables. Just saying that one sentence coming from a healthcare professional can be really impactful for patients.
Yeah, I think that's really good. Okay. So recently, Public Health England have released their latest strategy to tackle childhood and adult obesity. And I know that we all have our own views and opinions on this. But before I jump into that, just to refresh your mind on the Public Health England strategy, essentially, they challenge the food industry to reduce calories in products by 20% through three methods, either by changing the recipe, encouraging consumers to purchase lower calorie products, and reducing the portion size. However, they're not just targeting the food industry, as their One You campaign advises that we follow a 400-600-600 rule, which means 400 calories at breakfast, 600 calories at lunch, and 600 calories at dinner. Now, I know you both have your views on this, and I would love if you could share them and why you think this is a good or a bad idea. John, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So I think it's had a lot of negative press, the 400-600-600 campaign. But I think there are a couple. Yeah, it's mouthful. I get it wrong every time. But I think there are some positives to take from it. And I'd like to just touch on a couple of those, really, yeah. If that's okay. So I suppose the first one is, I think it's appreciating that a lot of people who I certainly see in clinic are having a diet which actually isn't as healthy as 400, 600, 600. Now, that's not to say that calories are equivocal to a healthy diet, but if we're being honest, we know that 2/3 of the adult population is overweight or obese. And I'd say that actually the majority of my patients are probably in that category as well. And when we know that being overweight or obese does actually contribute a significant risk to a number of health conditions, then actually it's important that we do address that. And I think one of the things that Public Health England are trying to do is look at the calorie consumption and trying to increase calorie awareness in people so that they could actually maybe make more suitable choices in terms of maintaining a calorie balance or maybe even getting to a deficit and losing a bit of weight. We know that will have some benefit. Now, that doesn't mean that, as I said, low calorie means healthy. And I think that's something that it's got a lot of criticism for, this message. But healthier for some of my patients, 400, 600, 600, actually it might be. And I can think of a number of patients where this would be applicable, where if they were able to lose a little bit of weight, then actually it would confer a benefit. The other side of it that I think is good is, and actually something that Zoe mentioned in a conversation that we had, was around pushing suppliers to change their methods of advertising, but also to change what's in their food. So I think Starbucks, McDonald's, Greggs, and Subway have all taken it on themselves to come up with meals which are these kind of lower calorie options, which does mean that people will hopefully be having a healthier version because it will be lower in calories. Debatable healthy anyway if it's from those kind of places, but a healthier option, and it will be lower calories, therefore not as high calories during the day, potentially lead to some weight loss or at least weight maintenance, which we know is such a big issue that we're kind of chasing. And I mean, Public Health England talk about the fact that they hope that with this campaign they'll, I think it's saved 35,000 premature deaths and saved the NHS about 9 billion, showing that this, you know, potential for reducing the calories will have a massive impact. And we see it in so many health conditions which are related to obesity and overweight. So I suppose my underlying message are, there are a few benefits from this message. It's not perfect. And I'm never going to say that lower calorie means better health, because ultimately I'd love all my patients to go away, have a wholemeal food diet, you know, lots of vegetables, plant-based, high fiber, colorful food. But if I think of a lot of my patients, I don't know if that's actually something that's very realistic or achievable for them. So maybe this lower calorie option, or at least some calorie awareness, might be a healthier option for them.
Yeah, and I think we need to remember that Public Health England are trying to do the best for the majority of patients, or the majority of people, actually.
Yeah.
Do you want to expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main point I want to get across to everybody listening on this podcast is to remember who this is for. This is not for most of our friends who are on Instagram who are talking about macronutrients and plant-based. And this is for people who've never heard of the word macronutrient. This is for people whose diets are going to be improved because of this. I've just been doing some filming this morning for the NHS at 70, and we were on a street called Parade Street in Paddington. And I was walking along the street, and within about 20 metres, you have McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, Subway and Chicken Cottage. And there was one sandwich shop, and they were all full. All those people are buying this type of food, not just as a treat once a month, like we might, but on a daily basis. They come out of their offices, they go into the fast food takeaway, and this is what they eat. So if that person is actually thinking, well, I need to try and limit my lunch to 600 calories. And that's another thing about this campaign. It's targeting people and meals outside of the home. It's not saying to start calorie counting when you're cooking. So if I'm somebody who goes to McDonald's every day for my lunch and I start thinking, okay, my lunch is about 1500 calories, I might choose to go somewhere else. I might choose to go to Boots, for example, and get a meal deal. And instead of choosing a triple-decker BLT, a packet of crisps and a Coke, I might think, okay, I need to choose the chicken and avocado sandwich, a packet of Snacker Jacks and a water or a Diet Coke. Now, that is still not a very nutritious meal, but if that person is going to have that meal 5 days a week for 50 years of their life, it's better for them to be having the guidance of the 600 calories than going for double that. So I think that's the important thing, is these public health messages are not for the people who are well-informed about nutrition. They're not from people from middle-class, affluent backgrounds. They're for the people that John and I see in clinic day in, day out, who have obesity, who have type 2 diabetes, who have depression, have hypertension and high cholesterol, who this message is really going to hit home. And the other thing about a public health message is it has to be one short, snappy sentence. And 400, 600, 600, you know, that's pretty short, succinct, and understandable by most people. When you start talking about even things like eating the rainbow, a lot of people don't recognise or understand what that is. So public health messages have to be simple, and they're targeting those with the worst health to get them to be healthier. And I think, just to reflect back on something that John said at the time, we're not aiming for optimal, we're aiming for better.
Yeah, and I think That's such a really important message. And when I originally read these guidelines, I wasn't 100% happy with them. And I think looking at them with, say, when you have that nutritionist dietitian approach, and I guess it was the nutritionists and dietitians that were a bit unsure about whether this was the right guideline or the right move to go for, because it's not perfect. And I still believe that it's not perfect, and I think we can all agree. But will it do better, and will it improve some people's health? And I think on reflection, it probably will. But it's only one piece of the puzzle. And like you said, John, calories are not everything. Low calorie doesn't always mean healthy. And I think the people who are well educated and can afford to cook from home and buy fresh fruits and vegetables, they should take these things with a pinch of salt. You know, you do not need to go home and start counting your calories and sticking to these guidelines. And I would hope that most people know that. Yeah. But like you said,
I think people need to be reminded, though, because we live in a world where, you know, we have those choices.
Yeah.
We can choose to go low carb or to, you know, go plant-based, and we have the time and the resources to build that into our lives. But a lot of people don't, and this is for them.
Yeah. So Zoe, you're part of a new program, the FAST Clinic. And in the first series, we see five type 2 diabetics undergo a very restrictive diet in a bid to reverse their disease and normalize their blood sugars. So can you tell us a bit about this diet and what results you had?
So this diet was based on some work that came out of Newcastle and Glasgow universities. Two very clever professors, Mike Lean and Roy Taylor, did a study, an intervention, where they took people with type 2 diabetes, and just with the support of their GP, they did a very low calorie liquid diet, which meant they only had 800 calories per day. And that was four shakes that were made up with water. And that's it. They didn't chew for 8 weeks, some of them a bit longer, some of them 12 weeks.
Oh my.
And the results were amazing.
Yeah,
at 12 months, 50% of those who participated, their type 2 diabetes was still in remission. So 50% at 12 months. Now, the only intervention we have for type 2 diabetes that can do that is bariatric surgery. No drugs that we have can do that. And what's great about it is it's low cost, it's low risk, it's available to huge numbers. It can be managed in the community by a GP, and it has the potential to save lives and save the NHS a lot of money. So this programme was really ITV entertained it up a little bit by taking these five very brave, amazing people, and we put them in a house under slightly unusual conditions, and we subjected them for 8 weeks to this diet. What's really important, and what people didn't see so much on the programme, was the reintroduction phase, the sustainability phase. So food was reintroduced gradually. So after the 8 weeks, one shake of their choice was removed and they had a meal that was around 200 calories instead. And gradually they replaced the shakes. Now, all five of them have done amazingly well. Three of them are now in remission. One is on her way there. She's just on the cusp of. And one of the guys is struggling a little bit, but in a much better position than when he started. So it kind of reflects the study, really. Yeah. Just over 50% of our guys are in remission. And that's 6 months on, nearly. So it's been a really incredible experience. Now, remember, there were certain points on their journey that there were a couple of points that I was in tears.
Really?
It was so emotional. And there were certain points I was literally flabbergasted. I couldn't speak. I was looking at the results thinking, in 4 weeks, this person has gone from having 27% of their liver fat cells to having 4% in 4 weeks.
That was, for me, the results were quite astonishing. But it is, like, we cannot deny the fact that it is quite a restrictive diet that would have to be done under the guidance of, you know, a healthcare professional.
Yes.
And these guys did have, they did have a lot of people around them. So in terms of practicality, do you think that we will be kind of incorporating this in the future, whether it's a low-cal diet for type 2 diabetics?
I do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And actually, we're looking in my practice now about how we do a small pilot with some patients. But, you know, it's not going to be for everybody.
No.
It's going to be for people who have type 2, who feel very motivated to do this very difficult challenge in the first 8 weeks. They need support from either their GP or a dietitian. And anyone who has type 2 diabetes who is taking medication for their type 2 diabetes mustn't try this without support, because that
Absolutely.
Can actually be very, very dangerous.
Yeah. And I guess the sustainability beyond that is probably more important, because it's one thing going into remission, but to remain there, you have to be very motivated to change your diet and change your behaviours in the long run. So I think if this is to be something that we're going to start prescribing as doctors, we're going to need like a full team of healthcare practitioners around us.
I think, yeah, and time is yet to tell as to whether that remission lasts 5 years, 10 years, forever. But even if it doesn't, even if that person has normal blood sugars for 2 years, and then, you know, they slip back into their old ways, that's 2 years that their body hasn't been under the insult of high glucose. That's two extra years of life without disability or life without heart attack, or, you know, life that they don't die young. So for an intervention that's so cheap, if they even just sustain it for a year, it's still something we should look to do.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting point, actually, in terms of the reduced time when we have got high sugar levels will confer a benefit.
Yeah.
But also, I think one thing that's worth noting is these diets, that they are hard. They're really hard. But actually, patients seeing the benefits and seeing those sorts of results is so motivating and so encouraging. You know, we've been in a time where we've really struggled with diabetes. It's 10% of the NHS budget. And we've now found something which, you know, isn't easy, but when it's got the potential to change disease to the point of being in remission and giving so much quality of life back. I mean, the guys on the show were incredible in terms of the way that they were just
super motivated.
Yeah.
But also just to see the effects that the changes had on them. Yes, they were on a really restrictive diet, but actually they ended up feeling better for it and feeling more energy, and despite being on a very low calorie, miserable diet, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
I'll share with you some of the things you didn't see in the programme. So Tracy, and she would be very happy for me to share this, Tracy has fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. When I first met her, we talked a lot about her levels of activity, because she wasn't able to do anything. She needed to hold on to two stair rails to get up the stairs. And she messaged me a couple of weeks ago telling me she'd just done her 5K. She has no pain anymore.
Oh my God.
Her symptoms have gone. She loves the gym. She's re-established her relationship with her daughter. And she's found her flair again. She's an artist. So she's written a book. She's painting again. She's embroidering again. So she's got her life back. And it's not just the weight that she's lost. She's actually got her life back.
Yeah. It's really inspiring to hear those stories. And I think all of us can relate to a lifestyle change, a positive lifestyle change when it comes to exercise and diet and sleep and all of these things that we talk about all the time. And I think we're so passionate about it because on some level we've experienced it ourselves. Yeah. And then you want to share that with everyone. And following on from that, because I need to wrap it up, even though I'd love to speak to you all day, can you each leave us with three healthy habits which you think we can all incorporate into our day? John, go first.
Okay. So I'm not going to include in my three two things which I think are vital, which is being active every day. Obviously, off the back of what I've been talking about, trying to reduce how much time we spend sitting. So trying to make sure we do get up every certain amount of time and reduce this potential for sitting disease. My second thing is prioritizing sleep. I've been reading that Matthew Walker book around.
Yeah, we spoke about that yesterday.
Just yes, amazing. So the impact sleep has on our health, our well-being, our performance, everything, including our dietary choices, our insulin sensitivity, all this kind of stuff is just incredible. So I've really been challenged by that. So getting more sleep and bettering my sleep as best I can. And then also the third one is something that I've actually got off one of our friends, which is at Doctor's Kitchen, Rupi, which is just
being grateful. Rupi.
Yeah, just that idea of having three things every day that you kind of talk to yourself or write down or share with your partner or share with a friend about things that you're grateful about. Because I think it's really important to reflect on those things because, you know, we have got healthy bodies and we're lucky that we're able to enjoy that. And there's always some good stuff to reflect on the day. And I think actually for a positive mental well-being, reflecting on those things is really important.
Yeah. Lovely.
Pretty good. I'm going to listen to that and take them on board. For me, when it comes to habits, I think they're so specific to the person. So instead of giving you three habits, I was going to give you three tips, if that's okay. So
I need them.
So my tips would be choose a habit that will make you healthier. Also choose a habit that will make you happier and work on two at a time and make sure that whatever those habits are, that they're sustainable long term.
Wow.
Like that.
That was powerful.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay. So thank you guys so much for joining me today. That was a really amazing podcast. Before you leave, can you tell us where to find you?
Sure. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Dr. Zoe Williams.
And I'm on Instagram on at the Health and Fitness Doctor. And I'm on Twitter as well at John_Sykes_6.
Amazing. Well, thank you everyone for listening and tuning in. Make sure to leave a review and let us know what you thought of the podcast. And also, please leave a rating. I'll see you next time. Thank you so much for tuning into the Food Medic podcast. Please do subscribe so that you are the first to hear about any new episodes. And if you are enjoying them, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review so that we can reach as many people as possible. Check out my website, thefoodmedic.co.uk, where you can find tons of recipes and articles. Follow me on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Food Medic. And my new book, The Food Medic for Life, is out now, which is packed full of loads of recipes, nutritional advice, myth-busting, and feature pages on topics such as sleep and mindfulness. You can grab both my books on Amazon or in any good bookstore. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.